This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Today for the Roundup, something different. Instead of reviewing the week's past top headlines, we'll look back over the past 2 decades. That's because this is The Exchange 20th birthday. On October 9th, 1995, NHPR kicked off this new program, which remains New Hampshire's only statewide call-in show. So to celebrate, we'll pull from the archives and reflect on some of the biggest news stories we've covered. And as always, let's hear from you. What do you see as some of the most important or most interesting headlines of the past 20 years? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor at New Hampshire Business Review. And Jeff, thank you very much for being here for this special edition of The Exchange.
Happy anniversary, Laura.
Thank you. And Dean Spiliotis, of course, you and I started our New Hampshire careers right around the same time. Thank you so much for being here as well. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's been a great 20 years.
Well, before we get into some of the big trends, guys, and the big stories on our roundup, with us now is our own Scott McPherson. Scott was the first producer of The Exchange. He and I launched the show 20 years ago today. Scott, you don't look a day over 30. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Laura, and happy anniversary.
Thank you very much, and right back at you. So just remind us, Scott, you know, the whole genesis of this idea. NHPR should have a talk show.
Yeah, at the time, NHPR had made a big strategic decision to invest more time and resources in covering news around New Hampshire, and The Exchange was really the first foray into the news at the time. NHPR aired classical music during the middays, and The Exchange was envisioned as a bridge to the classical music from the morning edition. And it was just an opportunity to talk about the issues of the day, current events, politics. And it was also envisioned as an opportunity for the different parts of the state to connect, because as a statewide network, we were able to bring together Hanover residents with Keene residents, with Portsmouth residents, to talk about the issues of the day.
One of the big questions I remember we got early on, Scott, was, this is New Hampshire. How are you going to find something to talk about 5 days a week? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember talking with you saying, okay, we're good through the presidential primary. And then what are we going to talk about? And 20 years later, there's been no shortage of topics.
Well, what was the significance of a new talk show at that time, Scott? Replacing classical music, you know, it was not a happy decision for everybody.
Yeah, it was a little controversial at the time. And at the same time, talk shows, radio talk shows, had a bad reputation as being places of acrimony and, you know, uncivil debate.
Yelling.
Yeah, yelling, you know, screaming and hanging up on people that you didn't agree with. And I think the vision that we had, and I think still is true to this day, is a place where both sides of the issue can be heard, that guests know that they can come on the show and hear both to be treated fairly and be able to present their side, even if someone that they disagree with is sitting across the table.
Well, Scott, you mentioned the original scope of the show, you know, news and information, issues of the day, connecting different regions of the state through conversation. What about some of the topics, though? We had a wider scope way back when.
We were less discerning in the topics that we chose. I remember a show on bagels. There's actually somewhat heated the New York contingent of bagels versus the, you know, Boston contingent for bagels. And apparently there's quite a controversy there that we stepped into. But
Jeff Feingold, who's from New York, is making a face. Yeah.
We did an outdoor show. Once a month, we would explore like an outdoor activity, whether it be kayaking, rock climbing, hiking. And we had a special guest, a writer from Outside Magazine, who would join us every month. And it was a great way to sort of explore different topics in New Hampshire. So I would say, in addition to the politics and the current events, we also did a little bit of lifestyle or life in New Hampshire.
Well, and as you mentioned, Scott, we started in the fall of 1995, right in the thick of the prep for the 1996 presidential primary. Wow, 20 years ago. What are some of your memories of that primary season? There were a lot of candidates coming in and out, even though we were brand new.
Yeah, and I think in 1996, that was the primary with Bob Dole, Pat Buchanan, Richard Lugar. And I remember a couple of stories in particular. One is you were doing an interview with Pat Buchanan, and at the time the studio was set up so that I couldn't see the door into the studio, and I was in the control room, and all of a sudden I see Pat Buchanan's wife walk into the studio and hand Pat Buchanan a note, and he just, you know, kept answering her question and started reading from her talking points. So his wife was feeding him talking points as we were live on the air, and it just completely shocked me. Another one is I remember Richard Lugar was a guest, and at 9:00
Indiana senator, known for foreign affairs specialty. Yeah,
yeah, he was due to be a guest, and it was 9:06, and he hadn't shown up, and the show had started, and you were reading the billboard. The open to the show as we were walking him into the studio and sitting him in front of the microphone.
Okay, that's happened more than once.
Yeah.
We won't name names, but that's happened. He was not the only one.
He was the first, maybe. So, yeah, and it was just, you know, telling people about the exchange, telling them what we were trying to do. It was a new show, and so it took a little bit of convincing to get the candidates on.
Right, because you were the one on the phone saying,
yep.
Hi, you've never heard of me or this show,
that's
but
right.
We're really hoping you'll come and give us an hour. And they did.
Yep, they
candidates seemed to have more time for this kind of conversation.
Yeah, it was much
back
different
then.
From what I see today. You know, there was no social media. There was no internet. And so for a candidate to have that much time to talk to the voters was pretty rare. And now my impression is that they don't want to be exposed for that long in an unscripted environment. The thing I liked to say after the presidential primary in 1996 is we had all the Republican candidates except for Bob Dole. And Bob Dole did not appear on the exchange, and Bob Dole did not win the New Hampshire primary. You know, so
that's right. Pat Buchanan
won.
It was a big upset. Peasants with pitchforks.
That's right. So
right.
I like to say Pat Buchanan appeared on the exchange and won the New Hampshire primary. See, there's a correlation there. So.
Well, one more primary memory, and then I'll let you go, Scott. And thank you so much. In 2000, Vice President Al Gore was running for the nomination, and he came in a couple times.
Yeah, and the way we found out about it, I was actually driving through Boston, and I got a phone call, and it's in the other end says, "Hi, I'm Agent Smith from the United States Secret Service, and the Vice President is going to be in your building on Tuesday. I need to get access," and that's how we found out that he was going to be a guest on the show. So we made ourselves available to Secret Service to do all the screening and whatnot, and they asked us how we screen the telephone callers. And I said, well, we take their name and their town and what they want to talk about, but we don't really know who they are. And the agent looked at me and said, that's okay, we know who they are. And he wasn't joking. He wasn't trying to impress anything.
Wow.
He was just matter of fact, like, we'll know who they are.
Well, and I was actually not there at the time. I was on maternity leave with my first son. But I remember stories of, like, Secret Service agents sort of crawling around the ceiling at the station over on North Main Street.
Yeah, we had to turn the building over to them during Morning Edition that day, and they came in with dogs, and they were checking basements, attics, crawl spaces, and that was pre-9/11, too, so I can only imagine what it's like today.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your memories.
Sure.
And it's just great to have started the show with you 20 years ago. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for hiring me on that day, because 20 years later, I'm still here, and it's all because of you. Thank you.
All right. That's Scott McPherson, again, original producer of The Exchange 20 years ago today. Today, Scott is Vice President for Operations and Finance here at NHPR. Again, this hour in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, but something different. To celebrate The Exchange's 20th birthday, we're looking back at some of the top stories of the past two decades in the Granite State. Let's hear from you. What do you think are some of the most important or just most interesting stories of the past 20 years? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And as I said earlier, our two guests for the hour are Jeff Feingold with New Hampshire Business Review and Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, just going to you first, we've covered so many political trends and changes over the past 20 years. What was the political culture of New Hampshire like 20 years ago, Dean?
Well, it was really kind of on the precipice of some pretty big changes. You know, traditionally it had a reputation as being kind of old school Republican with some libertarian flavor, fairly, you know, sort of a Granite of New Hampshire that you often hear about. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, I came here the same time you did. I'm not sure of my exact date of my first appearance, but it was with the 1996 presidential primary. And I remember you kept encouraging me to drive. I was teaching at Dartmouth, and you kept encouraging me to drive down to the studio. And at the time, Dartmouth had a very small ISDN line, literally in a closet in the public affairs office. And I used to sit in the closet and talk to you or whoever was filling in for you when you were on maternity leave. So when I first came here, I heard a lot about kind of the unique sort of Republicanism that was prevalent in New Hampshire. But as we know, it's changed ever since then, really starting in the late 90s. And ever since then, the state has been viewed as kind of purple, and we've had these swings between Republican control and Democratic control. And so it's resulted in kind of what I thought was initially very kind of staid political culture. It's actually turned out to be quite volatile and quite exciting for somebody who studies politics, certainly for at least 15 of the last 20 years, if not going back to the late 90s.
We're a purple state, so they say, Dean, right? Going back and forth between red and blue and very, very mixed. Jeff, I'd love your thoughts on this, too.
Yeah, it's interesting that Dean says this because if I think back to when I came to the state, it was in 1981, January. The state politically was so different. I mean, there was a Democratic governor, Governor Gallon, but other than that, it was of just almost completely Republican state. It was reliably Republican even in presidential elections. But then by 96, in 1992, Bill Clinton won the state. In 96, he won it again. And it really, I think, around that time, and then the election of Governor Shaheen began a real change in New Hampshire politics, if you think about it, because since then there has been only one Republican governor serving a two-year term in that time in the last 20 years, and that is quite an amazing thing when you think about who was the previous governor before. In 96, it was Governor Gallon, and 20 years before that, it was Governor King, and I don't even know how far back you have to go before then.
And Jeff, I remember when I moved here, people telling me Democrats who do well in the state are Democrats who work well with Republicans. That was what I was. So that's why Jean Shaheen was able to win the governorship, was because she was a sort of very moderate centrist Democrat. Yep. That was kind of the prevailing attitude when I first got here.
Yeah, but the election of Governor Shaheen really was the beginning of the change, and eventually led to even the Democrats controlling both houses of the legislature at certain points.
Well, and looking back, you're right, Jeff. Over almost 20 years from 1996 to today, there's been one Republican governor, which
serving
is an amazing
one term.
Shift. Serving one term. In fact, we've got a little bit of sound of that. This is John Lynch. His upset win in 2004 over the sitting Republican governor, Craig Benson. As you said earlier, Craig Benson was the only Republican to serve in the governor's office over the past almost 20 years. It was also notable because Craig Benson was the first sitting governor to not get reelection. So this was a big deal. Let's hear.
Thank you, New Hampshire. Thank you.
The Hopkinton businessman told supporters he was eager to get to work on issues like health care and education, but said his first priority would be changing the tone of state government.
I will work every day to earn the trust that you placed in me, and I will start by restoring integrity to the governor's office. Yeah!
In defeat, Craig Benson becomes the first governor in 87 years to be denied a second term. And Benson may be the state's only governor to have skipped his own election night party.
Again, that's NHPR's Josh Rogers reporting on the upset victory by Governor John Lynch in 2004, who went on to serve 8 years, which was also unprecedented. One of you mentioned also the changing tone of the Republican Party. And Dean, let's talk about that a little bit. This is a national story as well. The Republicans of old, when you first came to New Hampshire 20 years ago, have dwindled. They're still out there, but they've dwindled.
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, the state has sort of taken on kind of a split personality. You have this kind of libertarian strain that is still there that I think has been kind of augmented. We can talk about the Free State movement at some point if you'd like, which focused on, you know, libertarianism in New Hampshire. But we've also seen, particularly with the election of Bill O'Brien to the House speakership in 2010 to 2012, kind of the Tea Party reaction, the sort of movement conservative aspect of the Republican Party, at least for some period of time, coming into the state and having a big impact.
Well, during the House speakership of Republican Bill O'Brien, since you mentioned it, Dean, the more old school Republicans felt marginalized, unhappy about the direction of the party. Here's Republican House member Dave Kidder on the public radio program This American Life.
There's very few of us, you know, what we all call Rockefeller Republicans left. Everybody has just gone. Either they've either become Democrats or they've gone to the right. And I ain't going. I'm not going. My poor mother would come right out of the ground if she thought I was ever going to be a Democrat. And I am not going to kowtow to the right wing of the party. I don't think they're Republicans.
Again, that's Dave Kidder talking about the changing face of the Republican Party in New Hampshire. Jeff Feingold, what about Democrats? Have they changed?
Yeah, absolutely. The party has changed, obviously, to adapt to the rightward movement of the Republicans. And the most striking change is really that the party has, for the most part, embraced the so-called pledge. I mean, you have candidates running for governor who just have all taken the pledge. They just won't. Except for the one losing candidate was Mark Fernald, and we know what happened there. And I think that that's really become ingrained in the party at this point, even though that was the party that was looked to, the party of Arne Arneson and people like that who want to have an income tax. And there's still a big push in the party. There's still a block of people in the party who support an income tax, but they're not anywhere near as strong or prevalent as they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I can't remember the last time we talked about it. We used to talk about it all the time. Yeah. Real quickly, Dean, this has been part of national shifts in Republican and Democratic parties reflected here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, absolutely. You've seen nationally an increasing polarization in the parties. Some people like to blame, redistricting and gerrymandering of the districts to make them, you know, safe for progressives and safe for conservatives, and everyone in the middle is kind of eliminated in these sort of few competitive races that are still out there. We interestingly enough, as a purple state, have a number of those competitive races still. But yeah, there's certainly a polarization nationally that I think at some level we're seeing here. And I do think there's a greater tension now in the Democratic Party in the state between progressives and the sort of more centrist group of Democrats.
Jeff, did you want to jump in there, too, on these tensions that we see nationally?
Yeah. Yeah.
That Dean was saying. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I just wanted to say that it's interesting because what we're seeing in the Democratic Party, we're also seeing in the Republican Party, there are really a lot of just this real – these people are at loggerheads at this point, and there's a lot of anger. The most recent one nationally was just yesterday with the decision by the House Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, to just not – pursued being the speaker because he couldn't get the support of a large number of very conservative Republicans in the House. And this has happened in most recently in New Hampshire with the election of Sean Jasper as the House Speaker.
And it's going to be really interesting to see what the impact is on Governor Hassan as a Senate candidate because, progressives have been kind of emboldened with Bernie Sanders, and we see Hillary Clinton moving a little bit to the left. And, you know, Maggie Hassan for a long time was sort of part of this, the John Lynch, Gene Shaheen kind of mold of sort of center left. Which, you know, in fairness, was kind of sort of the prevailing Democratic ideology for a lot of the 90s with the Clintons. And so we'll see if she gets pulled a little bit to the left now in this big race.
Well, the other thing you have to look at is Kelly Ayotte also, because she's on certain issues. She is definitely not staying with the conservative wing of the party on this. And she knows that the Democratic New Hampshire electorate is much more to the center
Recognizing that, then maybe in certain many other states
in the country.
Well, one of you mentioned, I think it was you, Dean, the Free State Project, and that's been another big headline that we've covered over the past 20 years here on The Exchange. The Free State Project started to make an impact in the state about a decade ago. Here is Vice President of the Free State Project, Elizabeth McKinstry, just explaining what the mission of this project is.
Well, the Free State Project is a group of people who believe that there's not much sense in trying to convince the rest of the country that less government is better, that too much government is really too much government. And the best way to achieve what we call liberty in our lifetime is to get together in sort of an intentional community and find one place in the country where we can do what we need to do.
So, Dean Spiliotis, I remember when the Free State Project chose New Hampshire after a long deliberation. It was between us and a couple other states like Wyoming. What's been the impact of this, the people involved in this project over the past decade or so?
Sure. You know, this, I think they chose New Hampshire. It was around 2003. This movement goes back to around 2000, 2001. And the idea was to recruit 20,000 libertarian-minded individuals to move to a state and sort of influence politics at the grassroots. They've had something like 17,000 people sign the pledge to move, but I think in reality only a few thousand have actually relocated. It's interesting. I see kind of their impact in two ways. On the one hand, you know, they haven't had as big of an impact in terms of elected office as you might think. I think there are fewer than 20 free staters in the state legislature right now, so maybe a couple dozen at most. On the other hand, the sort of free state ethos or ideology has become, I think, shorthand for a particular view within the state. It really has sort of kind of functioned well as sort of an ideological option for people in the state, even if they're not, quote, free staters. They're perhaps best known in Keene for the Robin Hooding with the feeding the meters that has been the subject of a number of court decisions.
And following around the meter maids.
Yes, basically shadow the meter maids and feed the meters ahead of their ticket writing. So mixed impact. I think they've developed ideologically on the ground at the grassroots a little more mixed.
I do think they've had an impact locally in some of the communities where they settled. I know in the western part of the
and
state.
And also Grafton. I think they've been very active in zoning.
But the other thing that has always struck me from the very beginning when they announced they wanted to come here was that we already have people who embody what the free state's about in New Hampshire. That's why they live in New Hampshire. That's why we have on our license plate, live free or die. So it's not like this is a unique, unusual philosophy or attitude, way of life. People already live that ideal. And I think by coming in here and calling it, giving it a name, as Dean said, it kind of gives it a label.
Well, one of the areas where maybe they've had an impact or maybe New Hampshire would have done this anyway, gentlemen, is on civil unions, gay marriage. New Hampshire became one of the states to have gay marriage pretty early on. As we head into our break, here's Ruth Smith talking about gay marriage on the eve of the 2009 law going into effect. Let's hear.
The word marriage means something in this society, and a civil union, people don't really understand what it is. And, you know, socially, it's not really recognized, whereas marriage is. People understand what that means. They know that it's about commitment and love and a long-term life together.
Again, that's longtime gay marriage, same-sex marriage advocate Ruth Smith talking about why she feels marriage was important above and beyond a civil union. We will cover more of the big New Hampshire stories of the past 20 years in just a moment. Stay with us for this special edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and something a little different today to celebrate The Exchange's 20th birthday. We're looking back at some of the top stories of the past two decades in the Granite State. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. What stories do you think are the most important or just the most interesting of the past 20 years? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're going through some of the archives and reviewing some of the big headlines that we've covered on the exchange. We'd love to hear from you. Our guests in studio, Jeff Feingold, editor at New Hampshire Business Review, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Well, gentlemen, we spent a lot of time already talking about political shifts that we've seen in the Granite State. Jeff Feingold, what about economic shifts? Just where was our economy 20 years ago? I know that's a big question, but sort of put that on the map
first,
please.
Yeah, actually, in the last 20 years, the New Hampshire economy has changed dramatically. And I think only I looked up a figure for this show. In 1995, the largest private employer in the state was a company called Cabletron Systems, which was co-founded by former Governor Benson. They had over 6,000 employees in Rochester. In 2015, the largest employer is Market Basket.
Wow, and that's a big shift there.
And that's followed by Walmart and Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, and that shows the shift from a manufacturing-centered state, which we still have a large manufacturing sector. I'm not saying we don't, but we don't have those really large employers anymore, not many of them. There's BAE Systems. And then there's much more towards the services, and also healthcare has become a major part of the state's economy, along with financial services and things like that. But it's just the state was always a very strong manufacturing state. You go into any town or city along the Merrimack River, and you'll see all the mill towns and along just the Pemigewasset. But it's just not the same anymore.
Wow. Thank you so much for digging up those numbers. That says it all right there, those two data points.
Yeah. I mean, you think about Cabletron met not a very good demise, but in the end, those were really good jobs that paid a lot more money than, obviously Market Basket is a good place to work. Obviously, we know that from one of the major stories of the last 20
right,
years.
That's right. That was a big story last summer or the summer before.
Yeah. It is a good place, but it's nowhere near the same kind of quality of job, pay and the same kind of benefit towards on the rest of the economy that a manufacturing job would have.
Yeah, I love your thoughts too,
Dean.
Yeah,
it's interesting. We've had some ups and downs in the economy over the last 20 years. We've been hit by recessions just like the rest of the country. But, it's interesting sort of being here for 20 years and seeing that, in general, even in recessions, we tend to do a little bit better than other parts of the country. And for me, it's been interesting the way that has sort of masked some really big debates about the business climate in the state and the so-called New Hampshire advantage and, hearing business leaders tell me that, even though unemployment is lower than the nation, that the climate's not the way it should be to attract businesses. So it's been fascinating because people outside the state say, well, New Hampshire, you guys look like you're doing better than everybody else. Yet there is this sort of very intense debate about the business climate in the state.
Yeah, the unemployment rate is lower.
Yeah.
It's still in the low threes, but it's not the same as it was when it was low, and it was because people were working at jobs that were maybe paid better in different kind of sectors, and the other interesting thing really is that if you think about it, one of the major traumas to the economy was the 2008 collapse, financial collapse.
Sure,
and that led to
the Great
Recession, and New Hampshire really got hammered by that, and the state really has not gotten, I guess, its mojo back since then. I mean, we're doing pretty well. Actually, I was on a show with you on the exchange not too long ago. It's doing pretty well, but it's not the resilient economy we had 20 years ago.
Well, it's interesting, too, looking back in 1995 when the show started. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but New Hampshire was coming out of another recession in the early 90s, a recession that helped Bill Clinton do so well politically because he felt people's pain, in the early 90s. But by 1995, when the show started, New Hampshire was growing.
Absolutely.
The big problem was, where are we going to put all these kids? What about new schools, new housing development, families coming up from Massachusetts?
That is a really big difference
difference.
And in the early 90s, we really had a real estate depression in this state. It was a complete collapse. The five biggest banks in the state in one day were just disappeared. That was a major financial disaster in the state. But we recovered from it very quickly. Because as you said, but we haven't recovered yet from the Great Recession.
Longer.
It's still we're not. It's not like we're in recession, but we're still not don't have that vibrant economy.
Well, what's been fascinating to me is, you know, over the last 20 years, having, you know, bought a house and then moved and bought a second house, and you can sort of look at the kind of sales history of the homes over a 20, 30 year period, and you can see like who paid a premium because the economy was in overdrive, and who sold at a loss because we were in the recession. Yep. And so the housing prices in the state have been a fascinating barometer of the economy over the last 20 years.
Let's hear from you, too. Again, it's a special edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, celebrating 20 years of this program and looking back at some of the top headlines over that time. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. By the way, that's new, guys. 20 years ago, we didn't say find us on Facebook or Twitter. Let's go to the phones. Jim's from Goffstown. Hi, Jim. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thanks, Laura. Hi, I'm congratulations on 20 years.
That's, thank you.
Really wonderful. I have to say, I've been listening to you for quite a while, and I am a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. You are possibly the most even-handed interviewer and best interviewer on all of NPR.
Wow. I promise my mother did not set Jim up to this. Go ahead, Jim. Thank you.
I never met your mom. But I also noticed that when you were, I was worried when you were guest hosting for Diane Rehm, who is anything but the interviewer you are, with her little sighs and side innuendos. I was worried that we might lose you to the national stage. Please don't go there.
Well, Jim, thank you so much. What a nice present. Thank you very much for calling in. Keep listening, okay? All right. Thank you, Jim, for the call. Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So while we talk about economics, guys, I want to bring up a major story that sort of brings together both politics and economics, and that's the Claremont decision, 1997, December of 1997, right before Christmas. I remember it so well. The New Hampshire State Supreme Court ruled on education funding, basically blew open the longstanding system of education funding, and basically a decision that dominated the political discussion for like a decade and a half. We're going to play the introduction to our show that day, and then I definitely want to hear from you guys. Coming up next on The Exchange, the New Hampshire Supreme Court says the state's heavy reliance on property taxes to fund education is unconstitutional.
This is a terrific, wonderful event for all of New Hampshire's school children.
While I disagree with the decision, I am committed to working with the legislature to address the issues that are raised in the decision.
The court ruled in the Claremont Education Funding Lawsuit. The suit was first brought by five property-poor towns in 1991. The new ruling has everyone wondering what will replace New Hampshire's current funding system. The court gave the state 1 year to come up with a solution. I'm Laura Kanoy. Stay with us for The Exchange, right after the news on New Hampshire Public Radio. Okay, and there's that old theme music there with the saxophones blaring.
I haven't heard that in a long time. That's a good tune.
But, so the people in that billboard there, Dean, that little introduction, were Andrew Walensky, the lead attorney for the property poor towns, and then Governor Jean Shaheen, now a U.S. senator. And it's so interesting to hear that because, as I said in that introduction, everyone's wondering what will replace it. This was a huge deal. Changed the whole landscape here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, it's really something, you know, we came into the state. We'd had the 1993 decision that said that students have a right to a public education, and then this 1997 decision declaring the system unconstitutional and ordering the governor and the legislature to define an adequate education. And basically, you know, this has gone on for the next 10 years up until 06 when you know, after a number of governors and legislatures had not adequately addressed it, you know, it's again declared unconstitutional. And we have John Lynch trying to unsuccessfully amend the state constitution. So it seemed like something we just talked about all the time over that roughly 10-year period.
Yeah. Jeff? Well, and actually, in a lot of ways, we still are talking about. We're not mentioning the name Claremont as much anymore, but, you know, we still have a education system in the state that has a lot of inequity. And actually, as far as I know, that suit is still open. I mean, yeah. I think they could still go back to court and ask the court to look at it again. And I know that it's a threat that comes up every once in a while. And you know, and with this, with they came up with the so-called statewide property tax, which
the
is basically
donor towns, and yeah, the donor towns and all that stuff.
Yeah, they're not happy.
Right? And who's going to win and who's going to lose? Yeah.
Exactly, and it's still something we deal with almost every legislative session. We just dealt with the donor towns again, the so-called donor towns.
Although it's quieted down, Jeff.
It has quieted. Oh yeah, it's not the way it was 20 years ago when the
or even 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was a major thing. And, you know, actually, if looking back on it, it was so it was the only time I can remember where I believe the state Senate was about to pass an income tax. And but Governor Shaheen said she was going to veto it, so they never brought it to her desk.
Good memory. The House passed it. The Senate was unclear, and then Jean Shaheen said, "Don't do this."
She didn't want to be this governor who's, you know, because as we talked about the pledge type of stuff going on, and I think at some point we had proposals for a sales tax, and you know we had this statewide property tax mechanism or scheme, I guess is really what it is, and it's working on a functional level, but whether it's actually addressing the needs of those property poor districts. And it was just five plaintiff towns, but it's a lot more than five property poor districts in the state. And it's still an open question, you know, what the real results are going to be in the end.
Well, I want to ask you guys about another topic that dominated headlines for a long time and continues to, related to this perennial issue of how we fund education, how we fund our state budget, casinos, Dean Spiliotis. I can't count how many casino shows we've done over the years.
Yeah, we've been talking. It does seem like we've been talking about it forever. I think I've mentioned before that I moved here from Chicago, where there was a big debate over putting riverboat casinos in Lake Michigan. So I've now spent something like 30 years in two states, and we still don't have a full casino gambling other than the lottery. So it's just, you know, one of those things where I think both sides have dug in. I'm hearing the same arguments today that I heard 30 years ago, sort of for and against it. But we have seen it get closer and closer in recent years, and we've at one point even saw Governor Hassan kind of factor it into her budget at one point. But, you know, I just don't know at what point we would actually get it.
Well, and on a more sober note, gentlemen, another debate that has gone back and forth over the years is whether New Hampshire should repeal the death penalty or not. This has come up more recently with the death sentence of Michael Addison for the killing of police officer Michael Briggs in Manchester. Here is Manchester Police Chief Mara reacting to the death sentence verdict in 2008.
He got 9 weeks to have a jury deliberate whether or not he should be have a death sentence. Michael Briggs didn't get that. He didn't get that same courtesy, that same opportunity. And as a result, his family also got a sentence. They got a sentence of life without a father, life without a brother, life without a son, life without a husband.
Again, that's Manchester Police Chief Mara reacting to the death sentence verdict of Michael Addison. Another big story over the past 20 years here in New Hampshire. Today in The Exchange, we're looking back over 20 years of headlines. And boy, Jeff Feingold, not a lot to say except New Hampshire continues to debate this. It comes up all the time. It'll probably come up next year in the legislature.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it did come up next year. And it's an issue that it's really it's an interesting one in New Hampshire because we haven't had an execution in New Hampshire in, what is it, 70
since
years?
Like the 30s, I think.
Yeah, early 30s, I
and this really is something that would be – it would be just – an unusual situation in New Hampshire if this ever goes through, if he ever is executed.
Because it was theoretical up until now. Now there's actually a person there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a debate that's going on obviously all across the country. But it'll be interesting to see how this does play out in the end, because there's still a long list of appeals. I think he can still, his attorneys can still follow. So,
gentlemen, other stories that we should cover, and boy, it's hard to know where to begin. But there's also the idea of crazy weather, and I hate to say it because, you know, weather, of course, we always have weather here in New England. But, Dean, we've seen our fair share of sort of wacky weather events here in the Grand State over the past 20 years.
Yeah, we have. And I think, although I look at what goes on in other parts of the country with flooding and wildfires and other assorted disasters. And so, you know, we've had our rough moments, but we've also been spared on a number of occasions. But sure, you can pick any number of things that I can think of. Certainly the Alstead flood, which I think was roughly 10 years ago right now.
Yeah, right.
The 2008 ice storm, which was a big one.
1998
ice storm.
Also 1998 ice storm. Up in your area, that's right.
I remember the 08 one better, right. But yeah, up in the New London area in 1998.
Well, they had National Guard in New London. That was quite a experience.
Yeah, the Mother's Day flooding in 2006. I remember in my old Victorian learning about the hydrodynamics of my basement for the first time.
Hydrodynamics.
Yes, see how the old boulders in the foundation channeled the water through my basement. it's interesting. You know, the reason why this has been interesting to me from a political perspective is how governors deal with natural disasters is sort of one of the key indicators for how successful they're going to be at getting reelected. And, you know, I always used to joke about, you know, John Lynch's brilliance at wearing the windbreaker. He was just, you know, Lynch would show up in the middle of the night with handing out cards to call him on his cell phone and pushing people out of ditches in snowstorms. You know, Maggie Hassan has also done a good job of wearing the windbreaker. She gets that
the windbreaker.
Yeah, you know, they have the special gubernatorial windbreaker
like
or
Jim
parka.
Cantori from the Weather Channel.
Exactly, and they have the emergency operations center here that they're very quick to open up to kind of centralize. But seeing how the state deals with these storms, and I think with the 08 ice storm, something like 400,000 or 500,000 people were without, maybe 400,000 people were without power. And that was the first time I noticed something very interesting. So many people have generators now
that people were starting
to hoard gasoline. And I noticed in small towns, a lot of the gas stations just ran out of gas because people were filling up the jerry cans so that they'd have them to run their generators.
Right.
Yeah, but without the electricity, a lot of towns didn't even have gasoline because
you couldn't
run the
you
pumps.
You couldn't run the pumps either,
right? I do remember that 98 one very clearly.
That really hit your area.
Yeah, because we were out power about 5 days and some very cold nights.
Yeah. We lost power for 3 days during the recent Thanksgiving outage.
We almost
never lose power because we live right in town.
And I remember my wife, she was teaching at the middle school back then, and she was able to convince the police chief to allow her to – she had some chipmunks in her classroom that the kids would help raise, the students. And she had – she brought them to the emergency center in the elementary school so they get to keep an eye – so the firefighters and the guardsmen and the police looked after the chipmunk – I mean gerbils.
Gerbils, chipmunks.
Not
they
chipmunks.
Start
gerbils,
to look alike
gerbils,
after a while,
gerbils.
Jeff. That's understandable. Well, we had a kind of a scary weather event. We're used to ice storms and snowstorms and maybe even floods. But in 2008, New Hampshire had a tornado. Here's NHPR's Josh Rogers reporting on this 2008 tornado that affected central New Hampshire. He's talking to resident Charlie Toll of Northwood.
You know, it's just an act of God, you know, and that's it.
62-year-old Charlie Toll shielded his eyes from the sun as he surveyed what was once his family's lake house. All that's left now is the foundation.
This was a camp that we had for 38 years. My parents built it. I guess now we'll have something different for the next, hopefully, 38 or 40 years.
Again, ice storms, floods, blizzards, even a tornado. Just a sample of some of the many, many stories that we've covered here in The Exchange over the past 20 years. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk about more top headlines of the past two decades on this special anniversary edition of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And today, to celebrate The Exchange's 20th birthday, we're looking back at some of the top stories of the past two decades in the Granite State. Our guests are Jeff Feingold and Dean Spiliotis. And let's hear from you. What do you think are some of the most interesting or important headlines from New Hampshire over the past 20 years? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dean and Jeff, I want to open this segment with one of the big stories that affected New Hampshire, and that's the fall of the Old Man of the Mountain, May of 2003. I remember, actually, I was at a public radio conference in Florida at the time, and my husband called me at, 7 o'clock in the morning or something. And he said, I know what you're talking about on Monday on the show. I said, how do you know what I'm talking about on Monday? And he said, because the old man fell last night. So here is NHPR former news director Mark Beavis interviewing former Governor Craig Benson about the fall of the old man.
This is a huge chapter in New Hampshire history. The old man in the mountain has been around for 10,000 years, which if you do the math says it was around 8,000 B.C., and the old man in the mountain has come to mean so much to so many people, whether it's our freedoms and the live free or die, or whether it's the determination and hard work of the so many citizens we have in this state, or even the families that have gone up, enjoyed a day in front of the old man in the mountain and really bonded, that we have to do something to move forward. And we're closing a very long chapter, but let's open a new one that remembers all those things.
And again, that's former Governor Craig Benson talking about the loss of the old man of the mountain. So, Jeff Feingold, I remember this period of, you know, what do we do? Yeah. Do we, you know, do we just put up a couple photographs of what he used to look like? Do we try and rebuild the whole darn thing? I mean, what in the end ended up happening?
Well, yeah, it's funny because I remember reading one more, at one point somebody said we should put up a styrofoam version of the old man of the mountain. It was like, it was obviously someone still in mourning for the old man. You know, it's just kind of confused, but... you know, we ended up being really interesting. There's an outlook there where you can see where the old man stood, and you can look through some like kind of fine telescope type things.
It's pretty well done, actually.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. It's very well done. It's just not the same, you know, no matter what you do, to when you could drive through the notches there and see the old man. I mean, that really was quite an impressive sight. But the interesting thing to me is, you know, it was kind of symbolic of, you know, a lot of changes going on in New Hampshire at the time, but also, you know, it's still there. I mean, we have to use it as the old man is still our symbol of the state because we haven't been able to find another one. And in a lot of ways.
Could you really find a better one?
Well,
you
no, can. No, for especially for this state. And it really was that was one of the most important things that he served was that he was able to symbol. He was on when we had the state quarters, and that's the old man is on there. It's, you know, there's nothing. Then there was a hands down decision.
Well, another story that really dominated in the mid 2000s. So the old man fell in 2003. In 2004, Dean Spiliotis, Gene Robinson, the Episcopal bishop for the state of New Hampshire, was chosen as the Episcopal bishop and for the whole country. And it just it was a huge, huge deal and really upset the Episcopal Church globally.
Yeah, that's right. And so he is consecrated bishop in 2004. He had been married much earlier and had a family, got divorced in 1986, was in an openly gay relationship. You know, as a result of this, he was elected. I think I have the vote here. It was 62-45, so it was pretty close. But conservative Episcopalians in the U.S. were upset, and they abandoned the church and formed this Anglican Church of North America to align with conservative bishops outside of the United States. So it did cause a big shakeup in the Episcopalian Church. He's now retired. I believe he married his partner, but they may actually now be divorced.
Yes.
I'm not sure. So, you know, we have gay marriage in the state, obviously. Yeah. So, but at the time, it was a big national story, and it caused
an international story,
well,
really.
Particularly because conservative Episcopalians started to align with bishops outside of the state.
It still
has ramifications today, because I heard the other day that the Archbishop of Canterbury, head bishop of the whole Anglican Church, he's talking about having more autonomy to a lot of the churches, international churches, which is what a lot of the conservative churches want to have.
Well, and I remember covering it, and, you know, reporters from the BBC and,
all
over calling me and saying, what's going on with this? Let's hear a little bit of former Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson talking on NHPR, responding to continued challenges and questions over whether he should be the leader. This is from 2004.
One of the things that I've begun to say both to people locally as well as internationally is come and see. Come and see what life is like in the Episcopal Church here in New Hampshire and then determine whether or not you see God at work here.
Okay. And again, that's Gene Robinson, former Episcopal Bishop of the Episcopal Church here in New Hampshire and his election, selection, consecration, whatever is the correct term, did cause a big stir internationally. Gentlemen, another story having to do with an established church, Jeff Feingold, that we covered over the years a lot was the Catholic Church child sex abuse scandal. Now, that started in Boston, but it had repercussions here in the Granite State.
Absolutely did, and almost immediately, really. It was it revealed the revelations from that the Globe Boston Globe came out with almost immediately were felt in New Hampshire, and there were several really high profile, just I guess I don't know, nasty cases in New Hampshire, and also the former Bishop John McCormick, he had worked with Cardinal Law in the Archdiocese,
who was
at the center of it, and it raised there were a lot of questions raised about his involvement, and it's still the church is still going through this. Actually, there's a movie coming out later this year called Spotlight. I had a chance to see it at the Telluride Films in Dartmouth.
I haven't heard of that.
And it's about the Globe Spotlight team, the work they did in investigating this. It's really actually as a journalist, it was really. A very inspiring film, but when you think about the impact of that story, it's still to this day the church in many ways still has a lot to deal with.
Well, and some churches have closed down and so forth due to other changes too, not just that. One of the many stories we've covered over the past 20 years. It's so hard to get them all in, gentlemen. But here's an email from Bruce in Londonderry. He says, "Best wishes to Laura on 20 years. Has it really been that long?" Bruce, I asked myself that this morning. Bruce says, "I want to mention the shift of the New Hampshire primary. It seems to be pressured to go earlier and earlier. Bruce says, maybe we'll vote for president in November, and in December we'll have the New Hampshire primary for the next election." Bruce, thank you so much. Dean, he's right. It has come earlier and earlier. When my first primary here, I think it was, March 5th or 10th or... which seems late now, right?
Yeah, in the process, political scientists refer to it as front-loading. And basically what happens is other states are unhappy with the sequential ordering of the primaries and caucuses, so they decide to kind of step out of line and try to move up. And so I took a look back at over the last 20 years, and the last time we had a primary in February was 2000. It was February 1st. The last three primaries have all been in January, and the last two have been right after New Year's in response to the actions of other states. We're scheduled for February 9th this year, I believe, in 16. We'll see whether that holds. Bill Gardner says we have this law that says we have to be 1 week ahead of any similar contest. We've often joked about a Thanksgiving primary or a Christmas primary. I mean, he's willing to take it as far as he needs to. We've also heard recently from the RNC chair made some comments about that Iowa and New Hampshire, maybe they'll shake things up the next time around. That's going to be discussed over the next year. We've had that before. And so far we've been able to keep first in the nation. But absolutely, the primary, which in theory should be at the beginning of March, typically in the last 12, 15 years has been in January.
Yeah, the original idea was for the primary to be held on town meeting day, which is second Tuesday
in March. Right.
And that hasn't happened in many, many, many decades now.
Yeah, I remember the year, maybe it was last time around or the time before that, when it was very shortly after New Year's. Yeah. And I have to say that made me a little bit crabby. I wasn't quite ready to jump back in with full feet after the holidays. Thank you for the email, Bruce. This is The Exchange on NHPR. To hear this full program with all the stories, sounds, and reflections of the last 20 years of news here in the Granite State, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange, and listen back tonight at 8 p.m. So, gentlemen, just to finish up with you, I did want to go to another story that deeply affected everybody in the state, even though it happened in the North Country. This has to do with the Colebrook shooting. It's a very creepy story. Carl Draga, angry about everything, went on a rampage and seems kind of prescient, Jeff Feingold. I mean, now we see these shootings a lot.
I know, and it was, and I remember when it occurred. It was so disturbing because he murdered people. He murdered law enforcement personnel. He murdered a judge. He murdered journalists, and he obviously was an extremely angry man. He was eventually killed in a shootout, and it shook. it really did shake the North Country to its core and many other parts of the state as well.
Yeah, well, we have some sound. This has been 1997 from John Harrigan. This is the morning following the Colebrook shootings. Newspaper publisher John Harrigan joined the exchange, which was unbelievable, by the way, in his grief, to talk about what happened. But more importantly, and I think this is important for today, too, who we lost that day. Let's focus on those lives that were lost. So here's John Harrigan.
You know, Scott Phillips was the trooper from Colebrook, was just loved to death here, and he'd moved up here from a little bit to the south and had adopted the town. The town had adopted him. We kidded Scotty unmercifully about his cow lick. And he was always good for a laugh. He was a thorough pro, and the town will rally behind him and behind Vicky, whose ancestors go way back to the first settlers here. She was loved all over the area. And Dennis was a quirky newspaper guy with a warped sense of humor and left a big hole in this town. So Colebrook is a real tribal community when something like this happens. When we circle the wagons and bring food in by the ton and cry together and give the loved ones a good send-off, and emotionally and physically. We'll live through this, and we'll be a strong town after, but this is a hell of a wound.
Okay, again, that's John Harrigan, 1997, following the Colebrook shootings, where four people, beloved members of the community, as we heard, lost their lives. Dean Spiliotis, I want to close out, first of all, by thanking you for subbing for me on multiple occasions when I've been sick and on vacation and whatever. You got a couple emails there. I want you to read them, Dean, because it's kind of embarrassing. They're saying, congratulations, Lauren, that's great, but I feel funny reading them myself.
Sure, and let me say, it's been my great pleasure to work with you over the past 20 years, which is pretty remarkable that we were both sitting facing each other in a studio 20 years ago.
We're lucky to be here.
Yes, absolutely. So Rob is a regular. He writes in and says, Laura, I've been listening and emailing you for years, and you've always been receptive to my sometime contrarian views compared to what is generally heard on NHPR. Grace writes in and says, thank you for 20 years of excellence in covering issues of interest and importance to New Hampshire listeners. You're an outstanding host who brings interesting guests and adds intelligent commentary to compelling questions. And Allegra writes to Facebook about how helpful it's been to her, and she still listens practically every day and never stops learning. And I want to say on a personal note, I'm always amazed at the grace with which you and Dan Colgan and the control booth and the rest of the exchange staff deal with technical difficulties. If people could see sometimes what goes on in the studio, how seamlessly you guys do the broadcast. It's just amazing.
Or deal with difficult guests.
Oh, absolutely. We don't have difficult guests. Just kidding.
It's really amazing.
No, thank you guys so much.
It's been a great achievement.
You've been great over the years, helping us dig through these economic stories. If you're wondering, what the heck is this music? This is the original theme music by Grover Washington Jr. This was the theme music for the exchange for at least the first 10 years, probably more. So a little blast from the past here on the exchange. Thanks, guys, for being here.
Sure, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you, everyone, to listening over the past 20 years. This is the exchange on NHPR.